We're going to be in the book of Leviticus here this morning. If you have a copy of God's Word, I invite you to join me in Leviticus. I want to think just for a moment here at the outset about this theme of broken relationships. We all would know what it is to have a broken relationship, to have to do damage control, right? To have to try to repair something that was broken. Maybe there's been harsh words that were spoken or trust that has been broken. And you have to do that difficult work of trying to reconcile. Wounds can run deep, can't they? I was reminded of this proverb: an offended friend is harder to win back than a fortified city. Arguments separate friends like a gate locked with bars. It's extremely difficult to restore that relationship when it's been hurt. It would be easier to break into the, if I'm reading the text right, it would be easier to break into the Pentagon, a heavily guarded facility, than to be able to break into a person's heart who has put their barricade up, right? Who's been wounded and they're not going to let anyone in. That's really tricky stuff. I was thinking about this too. That's part of the risk of friendship, isn't it? You can only really be betrayed by a friend. You can only be betrayed by someone who had your trust. And we can avoid a lot of pain if we just don't let people get too close. If we just keep people on the fringe. But you also would miss out on the blessings of friendship, wouldn't you? It comes with the territory. To enter into a significant relationship means you open yourself up to that kind of hurt. And it's hard to repair it when it's been broken. I've been thinking about this recently as it relates to our current context, whether it be COVID or political dynamics. I think we're going to have to do some of this hard work as a congregation with each other. I've had conversations in the last few weeks and months about people who feel slighted. They feel offended. They feel like they've been displaced or pushed out of various ministries because of, you know, various factors. And it's all across the spectrum. There's people that feel hurt. It's going to take some serious effort and humility to restore relationships. And maybe you've had to go through that with a spouse or with a friend or with a parent or a child or a classmate or a coworker. You know what that involves. To have to take those steps, to have to lean in, right, and work through that process. And of course, this is all just describing what happens on a human level, right, between two sinful human beings. What Leviticus helps us to think about is the estrangement and the broken relationship that exists between an infinitely holy God and a sinful and rebellious humanity. How can that gap be bridged? How can that estrangement become reconciled? This is really what Leviticus addresses. It's such a foundational topic, so critical for our understanding of the rest of Scripture. So we are continuing our way through the road trip through the Bible, 66 books. We're continuing to focus on that little orange stack to the top left. Those are the first five books of the Bible: Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. There's certain things that you can see more clearly when you're up high that you cannot see when you're down close, right? So our goal is to, we're obviously going to be doing a very quick overview of Leviticus today, but I think in some ways might be more helpful for us than diving into the minutiae and into the details. I would say, too, before we get too far in, some of you have embraced the challenge to read through the Scriptures here this calendar year, and I want to commend you for that. Some of you have come up to me and described the plan that you're using. Some of you are using the plan that we've laid out that's referenced there in the bulletin, but I just encourage you to carry on with that, and it's not too late to get started, but you're going to need a plan. You're not going to just wake up and just feel this unction I'm just drawn to pick up my Bible. It's going to take discipline, and you're going to have to work at it and prioritize it. I think it's helpful to have a place where you read, and I think it's helpful to have a time when you read. Establish some disciplines in that way, and I think it would pay rich dividends for you. You might also take the opportunity here to memorize the books of the Bible. Now, if you are like me and grew up in the church, and I went to a kids club program, and that was I got candy bars for memorizing the books of the Bible. But that's not everybody's experience. And this might provide a good context to just over the course of 52 weeks to kind of try to lock those in. So I actually had somebody approach me last week and said, I'll provide prizes for kids or adults. So I got to explore the details on that, but there might be something in the works. But it is a great opportunity just as we move through to start locking those things in and just gain that bigger perspective of Scripture. So Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus. See, you're well on your way to having mastered those books of the Bible. As Craig alluded to already, Leviticus is not an easy book to read or understand. A lot of Bible reading commitments have crashed and burned in Leviticus. I mean, it is a lot of details to get bogged down in, a cataloging of the various sacrifices that were called for in the law and the intricate qualifications for the priests who would serve in the tabernacle. Leviticus is also challenging because there's not much narrative. There's not much action, as it were. There's not much movement. Genesis and Exodus, we're all over the place. There's a rapidly moving storyline, right? We start with Adam and Eve and all the events in the Garden of Eden. Then you have the debacle with Cain and Abel and Cain killing his brother. And then you have Noah and the ark and the global flood. You have the Tower of Babel. You have Abraham's journey to Canaan. You have Joseph's winding path to Egypt. You have Pharaoh and the plagues. You have the Red Sea crossing. You have fire at Mount Sinai. Leviticus is different than that. It all happens in one location. There's no movement. There's very little narrative in the book. But there's something so significant that happens here. There's a reason that they stopped the bus here on the journey. Okay? And they needed to get a hold of this. We need to get a hold of this as well. Leviticus is so critical. It's such a foundational piece here for us. So as we think about Leviticus, let's just step back again and remember where we are in the biblical story. God created, and when humanity rebelled against God, they were put out of the Garden of Eden. A curse came over creation. Everything was changed, right? Their Adam and Eve's relationship with each other, their relationship with the soil, their relationship with their bodies. They encountered pain. And most of all, of course, their relationship with God was severed. They were put out of the garden, out of fellowship with God. But God put in motion a rescue plan to redeem humanity, to restore humanity. And of course, it's centered on a man named Abraham. God entered into a covenant relationship with Abraham and his descendants. God promised to bless Abraham, to prosper him, to give him a land, to make him into a great people, and through him to bless all the nations of the world. God showed himself faithful to those promises. He preserved Abraham and his descendants, even when things looked pretty shaky. And eventually God brought Abraham and his descendants into Egypt, where he protected them from a severe famine. And then when they became enslaved in Egypt, God once again showed covenant faithfulness to them in their moment of greatest need, when they were completely helpless and they cried out to God. God showed up and delivered them with a strong arm. He brought them to Mount Sinai, where he gave them his instructions. He reaffirmed his covenant commitments with them, and he reiterated his intent to make them into his distinct people in the world. There at Sinai, he gave them instructions for the building of a tabernacle with all of its furnishings, including the Ark of the Covenant. The tabernacle, or the tent of meeting, would be the place where God would meet with them. It would be the place where God would presence himself in the midst of his people. Exodus concludes with God's glory filling that newly constructed tabernacle or tent. Here's the account here at the end of Exodus. Then the cloud covered the tent of meeting, and the glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle. Moses could not enter the tent of meeting because the cloud had settled on it, and the glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle. So this is where we ended last week, and this is a beautiful scene, isn't it? I mean, ever since the garden, people have been separated from God, cut off from His presence. Here now, God establishes His presence with His people there in this tabernacle or this tent. But something's missing, isn't it? There's a problem here. Moses, even Moses, godly, humble Moses, could not enter the tent. He couldn't stand in the presence of God. So we have, as we move into Leviticus, into that first verse of Leviticus, the Lord called to Moses and spoke to him from the tent of meeting. God in His glory is in the tent. Moses is outside the tent. And God calls out to Moses. Right? So we get the sense that right here at the outset of this dissonance that's taking place between God and the people. And of course, that barrier was the barrier of sin. It cropped its head very early after their exodus out of Egypt, right? They were at Mount Sinai. Moses hadn't even come down the mountain yet with God's commands, and they had already violated those commands, rebelled against God. They created a golden calf. And God said, Exodus 32, I'm going to destroy these people. I'm going to start over. All is not well here in their relationship with God. Sin was already a major problem here. Here in Leviticus, they parked the bus. And God gives instructions about how the people can approach Him and how they can live in fellowship with Him. This is crucial stuff here in the life of the Jewish people, and certainly powerfully instructive for us to know how sinful humanity can approach a holy God. The book came to be called Leviticus, which means that which pertains to the Levites. So Moses' brother Aaron was commissioned as priest. And the Levites, they were from the tribe of Levi. The Levites would all help in the aspects of worship within the community of Israel. So you remember Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and then Jacob had 12 sons. One of those sons was Levi. Those 12 sons would become the 12 tribes of Israel. But God singled out Levi and said, Levi, your tribe is going to be different than all the other 11 tribes. You're going to be the people that are going to represent me before the nation. And so God plots that out. But this really, Leviticus is not just about the Levites. It's not just about the priests. It's about the core human problem, which is our separation from God and how that can be remedied. Right? So several concepts that we're introduced to as we move through the book. The first is that of sacrifices. Sacrifices. And here's the key question that is answered here in this opening section. Again, the fundamental question, how can sin be atoned for? How can sin be atoned for? God had told Adam and Eve in the garden, if they were to sin and rebel against Him, the penalty would be death. Right? That's the equation. And so there has to be death. God is a just God. He can't just overlook sin. He can't just look the other way. Somehow His justice has to be satisfied. There has to be a payment for sin. And it's unpacked here right at the outset of Leviticus, beginning in chapter 1, verse 3. If the offering is a burnt offering from the herd, you are to offer a male without defect. You must present it at the entrance to the tent of meeting so that it will be acceptable to the Lord. You are to lay your hand on the head of the burnt offering, and it will be accepted on your behalf to make atonement for you. You are to slaughter the young bull before the Lord, and then Aaron's sons, the priests, shall bring the blood and splash it against the sides of the altar at the entrance to the tent of meeting. You are to skin the burnt offering and cut it into pieces. The sons of Aaron, the priest, are to put fire on the altar and arrange wood on the fire. Then Aaron's sons, the priests, shall arrange the pieces, including the head and the fat, on the wood that is burning on the altar. You are to wash the internal organs and the legs with water, and the priest is to burn all of it on the altar. It is a burnt offering, a food offering, an aroma pleasing to the Lord. So there's just a little snippet, right, of all these regulations. And right at the outset, we have mention here of the sin offering, blood sacrifice. The animal had to be without defect. It had to be a costly sacrifice. The individual would place their hands on the head of the animal to identify with the animal. This animal was going to be killed for their sin. And so there was this physical identification with the animal. And then the individual would kill that animal. And the priest then would take the blood from that sacrifice and sprinkle it on the altar. And of course, the text is quite explicit. The altar stood right at the entrance to the tent of meeting. Before anyone could go into the tent of meeting, into the presence of God, there had to be atonement made for sin. A powerful picture, just in the way that it was all laid out. Other sacrifices were offered, grain offerings, fellowship offerings, but all these other sacrifices could only be acceptable after sin had been atoned for. We learn here again at the outset that sin separates us from a holy God and requires blood atonement. We're also introduced here to a concept regarding the priests in chapters 8 through 10. I think here's the key question here. Who can mediate between God and the people? God had established certain representatives who would serve as mediators. Again, Moses' brother Aaron was designated as the priest. Again, from the tribe of Levi, and his sons would serve as priests. Of course, the priests were sinful themselves, so they had to atone for their own sin before they could then participate in helping the people atone for their sin. So we read about this in chapter 8, a commissioning service that God established for the priests here to set them apart for this unique ministry. Leviticus 8:1, the Lord said to Moses, "Bring Aaron and his sons, their garments, the anointing oil, the bull for the sin offering, the two rams, and the basket containing bread made without yeast, and gather the entire assembly at the entrance to the tent of meeting." Moses did as the Lord commanded him, and the assembly gathered at the entrance to the tent of meeting. And then down to verse 22, he then presented the other ram, the ram for the ordination, and Aaron and his sons laid their hands on its head. Moses slaughtered the ram and took some of its blood and put it on the lobe of Aaron's right ear and on the thumb of his right hand and on the big toe of his right foot. Moses also brought Aaron's sons forward and put some of the blood on the lobes of their right ears, on the thumbs of their right hands, and on the big toes of their right feet. Then he splashed blood against the sides of the altar. So once the priests then were consecrated, they offered sacrifices for the people. We see into chapter 9, verse 22. Then Aaron lifted his hands toward the people and blessed them. And having sacrificed the sin offering, the burnt offering, and the fellowship offering, he stepped down. Moses and Aaron then went into the tent of meeting. When they came out, they blessed the people. And the glory of the Lord appeared to all the people. Fire came out from the presence of the Lord and consumed the burnt offering and the fat portions on the altar. And when all the people saw it, they shouted for joy and fell face down. So the priests are consecrated. Their atonement is made for their sins. And then they work to make atonement for the people. And then God shows up. He sends fire in some extraordinary way and consumes the offerings there on the altar. And notice the reaction of the people. It says they shouted for joy and they fell face down. God had accepted their offerings. God had been pleased with what they brought. In some sense, they were able to be reconciled to God. They were able to be in his presence. Moses and Aaron actually here in this particular text were able to go into the tent of meeting. And then come back out and proclaim a blessing over the people. So it's a great scene here of how this whole system was to work. And they caught a glimpse of what it is to be reconciled to God. Now, this section closes with a cautionary tale. It's one of the few little narrative portions, and it has to do with Aaron's two sons. Leviticus chapter 10. Aaron's sons, Nadab and Abihu, took their censers, put fire in them, and added incense, and they offered unauthorized fire before the Lord, contrary to his command. So fire came out from the presence of the Lord and consumed them. And they died before the Lord. Moses then said to Aaron, "This is what the Lord spoke of when he said, 'Among those who approach me, I will be proved holy. In the sight of all the people, I will be honored.'" Aaron remained silent. Sometime after their commissioning, right, we have this beautiful scene of Aaron and his sons being commissioned and offerings being made for the people and God showing up in an amazing way and the people filled with joy. Some time passed and Nadab and Abihu offered unauthorized fire to the Lord. What in the world is that all about? Well, in Exodus, we have instructions. There was an altar of incense that was to be in the tabernacle or in the tent of meeting. And after the sacrifices were offered, the priests were to come in. They were to put a very specifically prescribed blend of spices on the coals, on that altar of incense. And it would give off a certain aroma there in the tent. And we don't really know what happened to Nadab and Abihu. Maybe they came up with a little better mixture that they preferred, a little bit of lavender, a little bit of vanilla orange splash, you know, there, whatever. The key word here is it was unauthorized. It was something contrary to what God had commanded. And God struck them dead. And this pronouncement that is made here, that God is to be treated as holy among his people. God says, "I will show myself holy. I'm not to be trifled with or manipulated or disregarded." And they learned very clearly, not only about blood sacrifices, but they learned that you only approach God on God's terms. Only approach God on God's terms. We live in a day and an age where people have their own versions of truth, right? They're very much reflective on, you know, how things appear to them. I could never believe in a God who did this and that. But there's an objective truth here that was handed down to the people of Israel. This is how you are to approach God. It's so instructive for us. God is not to be approached in any way that we would please, but only on his terms. There's also a section here regarding ritual purity, chapters 11 through 15. I think it answers this question: how can one prepare to enter God's presence? And God put certain things in place. He said, if these conditions are not met, then you cannot approach me. And these categories of clean and unclean were developed and put in place. They would be unclean by eating certain foods, right? We would call, in our context, kosher foods. They could eat a cow, but not a pig. They could eat salmon, but not shrimp. Here's the important one. They could eat grasshoppers, but not beetles. Okay? So all of these various things related to dietary issues that they needed to remain clean, ceremonially clean, by what they ate. They would be unclean after childbirth. Chapter 12 gives a whole section on that. They would be unclean if they encountered any type of contamination, a rash, a skin disease, some kind of mold. These were things that would cause them to not be able to enter into God's presence. They would be unclean due to reproductive fluids. A man would be unclean if he had an emission of semen. A woman would be unclean during her monthly period. A lot of questions as to why God declared these things to be unclean, why he made these distinctions. These regulations seem somewhat random, a bit strange to us. It wasn't that these things were evil in any inherent sense. But again, God was calling them to be his distinct people. He was teaching them categories of clean and unclean. You don't just approach God flippantly. There's a sense of setting yourself apart from normal, common things when you encounter God. If you had a meeting scheduled with a famous athlete or an actress or somebody that was considered very wealthy, maybe in our culture, you would make preparation to give thought to what you were going to say to them. And God seemingly is establishing something similar for his people to help them create a sense of, again, of his holiness. I was thinking about this as it relates to prayer. There's a tension between spontaneous prayers in a corporate setting and prepared prayers. Our tradition is generally valued spontaneous prayer. We don't want to engage in empty ritual, do we? We want to come to God authentically. But there's a tension there, is there not? Because we can come to prayer sometimes not just spontaneously, but flippantly, without a lot of thought to what we're going to say to the God of the universe. Be good for us to give thought. The psalmists, when you read the Psalms, it's clear there's an element of preparation there as the psalmist addresses God. So God puts some things in place to cause them to prepare themselves to enter into his presence. Then there's the Day of Atonement. We can't get into Hebrew, the way Hebrew grammar works or the way literature works in a Hebrew context, but there's many people have suggested that actually this section on the Day of Atonement is kind of the focal point of the book of Leviticus. And I think it answers the question, what about sins committed unintentionally? What if we don't catch all of the sins? What if we don't make appropriate sacrifice for all of the sins? Day of Atonement was the most solemn day in Israel's calendar. We read about this in Leviticus 16, verse 5. From the Israelite community, he is to take two male goats. This is the high priest. From the Israelite community, he is to take two male goats for a sin offering and a ram for a burnt offering. Aaron is to offer the bull for his own sin offering to make atonement for himself and his household. Then he is to take the two goats and present them before the Lord at the entrance to the tent of meeting. He is to cast lots for the two goats, one lot for the Lord and the other for the scapegoat. Aaron shall bring the goat whose lot falls to the Lord and sacrifice it for a sin offering. But the goat chosen by lot as the scapegoat shall be presented alive before the Lord to be used for making atonement by sending it into the wilderness as a scapegoat. Interesting imagery, isn't it? Two goats, one of them is to be chosen and offered as a sacrifice. The other, the priests were to place their hands on the heads of that goat and proclaim and confess the sins of the people. And then send that goat out of the community, out into the wilderness. Again, a symbolism of their sin being taken away outside the community. Powerful images conveying atonement and purification from sin. Sometimes people would perhaps forget to offer a sacrifice. Sometimes they just neglected to do so. Sometimes they sinned without even realizing they had sinned. And so there was a mechanism put in place for the priests to offer sin for the nation once a year. The only time that the priest would be able to enter into the Holy of Holies, where the Ark of the Covenant was, where God was presencing himself over the Ark. And there's a final section here on holy living. I think, again, answering this question, in what ways should our lives be distinct? Up to this point, it's been about certain ceremonies and rituals, and the people were given a holy status before God, right? But we see here towards the end of Leviticus that God not only desires for us to have a holy status, but to have holy lives. There's a series of instructions here in these closing chapters that outlines how they're to live. Not just when they go to the temple, but how they're to live as God's holy people. So sometimes this is called the Jewish Holiness Code. Very difficult to outline this section, to try to somehow categorize it. I'm just going to give you a sampling of some of the instructions that are given here. They were not to eat blood. Chapter 17. They were not to engage in deviant sexual behavior. Matter of fact, Moses says here, God says, Moses is the one writing and recording, but God says, you must not do as they do in Egypt. In other words, how they act and conduct themselves sexually in sexual relationships is one thing in Egypt. It's one thing out there among the nations. But these are my guidelines. These are my parameters for sexual expression. Obviously, he addresses homosexual expression, right? He declares it to be detestable here in chapter 18. But he also prohibits a whole range of other sexual violations and perversions. A person is not to engage sexually with a close relative or with someone who's already married to someone else. He puts forward a very distinct ethic of sexuality that was to make them distinct from all the peoples of the earth. We have a great statement in these chapters in chapter 19, verse 2. Speak to the entire assembly of Israel and say to them, be holy because I, the Lord your God, am holy. So again, he's calling them to be marked by holiness, to be different than the other nations. The instructions just mount. Do not sacrifice one of your children to Molech. Right? This was a common practice. It involved kind of an element of superstition. You wanted to appease the gods and you had to give them something valuable. And so that was characteristic to offer a baby as an offering to the god Molech. God said, we're not to go down these superstitious roads. Right? They were not to harvest the edges of their fields. There's an interesting one. So you're a farmer, you have a plot of land, the crop grows. When you go to bring in the crop, leave some of the crop standing around the edges of your field. That was part of God's way of helping them show concern for the poor among them. Leave some there that the poor can come and glean from. That's, again, unique, right? That's different. That's a unique kind of love. Do not wear clothing made of two kinds of material. I have no idea why God would have done that, other than he wanted them to be distinct, to be different. Do not practice divination. Stand up in the presence of the elderly. A whole section about how to treat older people within the community. Again, this is to be a distinct characteristic of the people. Do not mistreat foreigners. And specifically again here, he draws in Egypt. Because the people of Israel knew what it was to be mistreated as foreigners, didn't they? To be enslaved. God said, that's how they do it in Egypt. That's not how it happens among my people. Remember that you too were foreigners. Remember that you too were once oppressed. And show kindness. No matter where you're at on immigration policy, we are called to welcome those who are vulnerable. That should be a core element of our ethic as followers of Christ. Observe the appointed feasts. Again, very specific instructions. I want you taking time off each week to observe the Sabbath. I want you taking a week off at these increments to observe the various festivals and feasts. I want my people characterized by joy. There at the end, chapter 27, God gives instructions about the tithe. Give 10% of all you receive, a way of acknowledging God's ultimate ownership of all that we have. There's a section in chapter 25 about the year of Jubilee. We don't have time to get into all the details, but it's fascinating. Land was entrusted to you, it was assigned to you, there was an inheritance given to all the 12 tribes of Israel. If you became indebted, if you went bankrupt, then you might have to sell your property. But property was never gone forever. After 49 years, all property would revert to its original owners. That was the year of Jubilee. If you had had to sell yourself into slavery, you were released when the year of Jubilee came. It was God's way of sort of preserving people from generational wealth and curbing any sense of hoarding, any sense of hopelessness where people would find themselves unable to dig out from their situation. I mean, God put all these things in place for the welfare of His people and to help them treat one another with love and kindness. But you can't miss this when you look at chapters 18 through 27, that holiness involves the whole life. It's not just about a ceremony. It's not just what you do when you go to the temple or when you go to church, right? But God's desire for holiness is all-encompassing. This section also includes a brief narrative that highlights the call to holy living. Leviticus 24. Again, one of the few narrative portions here in Leviticus. Leviticus 24, verse 10. Now the son of an Israelite mother and an Egyptian father went out among the Israelites, and a fight broke out in the camp between him and an Israelite. The son of the Israelite woman blasphemed the name with a curse. So they brought him to Moses. His mother's name was Shelomit, the daughter of Dibri, the Danite. They put him in custody until the will of the Lord should be made clear to them. Then the Lord said to Moses, "Take the blasphemer outside the camp. All those who heard him are to lay their hands on his head, and the entire assembly is to stone him. Say to the Israelites, anyone who curses their God will be held responsible. Anyone who blasphemes in the name of the Lord is to be put to death. The entire assembly must stone them, whether foreigner or native-born. When they blaspheme the name, they are to be put to death." Wow. I mean, this is not murder. This is not theft. This is a few misplaced words, right? And yet, God wanted to cultivate a sense of holiness among His people, and He left a very clear message at the outset of their life as a community. There's this interesting backstory here, because this guy who had cursed God was the son of an Israelite woman and an Egyptian father. Presumably that Egyptian father was one who had come out of Egypt with the Israelites at the Exodus. So who is this guy? Is he an Israelite? Is he an Egyptian? How should we treat him? God says it doesn't matter. If he identifies himself as one of my followers and he's in my community, he is to be held accountable, right? There's purity that is required among my people. You can't miss God's seriousness, how serious holiness is for God's people. Let's consider what's transpired here. Leviticus 1:1, the Lord called to Moses and spoke to him from the tent of meeting. Right? Moses on the outside, God on the inside. When we get to Numbers chapter 1, that's the next book now, right? That's where we're going after Leviticus. Says that the Lord spoke to Moses in the tent of meeting in the desert of Sinai on the first day of the second month of the second year. So God instructed them on how they could be reconciled to God, how they could atone for their sin. It was a rather cumbersome process, wasn't it? But they were able to enter into God's presence. Such a foundational principle that is unpacked for us here in Leviticus that shows us how God is to be approached. Now, a couple of brief gospel glimpses as we close. Jesus is the perfect sacrifice who accomplishes atonement for sin. Right? I don't know, I read Leviticus, I get tired just looking at all of the different sacrifices. And it was a repetitive thing. You'd have to continue to come back to the temple, continue to offer sacrifices. I found myself just a sense of relief and joy to think that Christ has offered a sacrifice unlike any of the sacrifices prescribed here, a perfect human sacrifice, a once for all sacrifice to atone for human sin. And Jesus is the great high priest who is able to enter the tabernacle, We look at Aaron. He was relatively good and godly, but then Aaron died and his sons came on the scene and that didn't go so well. And Jesus is the great high priest. He's the perfect high priest, the righteous high priest. He's an eternal high priest. He never dies. He's able to mediate for us. It's what he's doing right now at the right hand of the Father, mediating on our behalf. And so this wonderful picture, again, pointing us ahead to the atonement, the full atonement that has now been accomplished and provided through Christ.